Okay, go ahead.
My office hours are normally on Thursdays from 2 to 4, but we're moving them to Monday since there's one. So, and since there'll be an assignment out, I will also be holding office hours by appointment.
Okay, so Scott, you're going to, next week, you're going to do your office hours on Monday, what hours?
2 to 4.
Same
time, different day.
That's not usually how that phrase goes.
All right.
I'm not Batman. What are you thinking of? Oh my
goodness.
I really don't know what this game was rated for. Just FYI.
All right. So, those of you,
what, do I have, like, body odor or something and all of you are hiding out in the back? Do you have this misguided idea that it will actually help?
Oh, it's power.
You know, and all this time I thought that the faculty member had the power in the classroom, but thank you for correcting me on this. This is good. The power is all in the back of the room.
Well, I have the floor, but that's okay.
Okay. That's cool. I can understand why being plugged in would be more important. Okay, so those of you who track email incessantly may have noticed that the second round project assignment is out as of about 5 minutes ago. And I tried to do a better job specifying it than I did the last one. Intuition is to implement the equivalent to a Unix-style pipe as an object. Now, conceptually, this doesn't sound hard, except it's a classic producer-consumer problem. The buffer in the middle. And the buffer has bounded size. So there are situations where the readers may not be caught up, and the writer may go to put, and there may not be enough space in the buffer, and that can cause the writer to block. Or conversely, the reader may go to read, and the writers may not be caught up, there may not be enough data to satisfy the read, and the readers may block. Okay? So in contrast to the null stream and the zero stream, where there were no blocking operations, in this case, there are blocking operations. We're going to have to invoke the blocking mechanism. You're going to have to do buffer management. And there are corner cases in buffer management of this sort. In particular, if the buffer, so obviously, if the buffer is less than the write length limit, then you might imagine you would get writes that are too big. And it has to be well defined what would happen in that case. Turns out, if the buffer is less than twice the write length limit, you can still get into some interesting corner cases. So this is a problem assignment that's going to require some thought. There is nothing in this from a producer-consumer problem standpoint that you shouldn't already be basically familiar with. And there's nothing in this in terms of IDL requirements that goes substantially beyond what you've had to deal with in the null stream and in the zero stream. Yes, you'll have to implement a write case, but the write case is not what you'd call hugely exciting. In fact, if you think about it, the reply to the read operation was a write. If you have a working read operation from the zero stream, you have both halves. Implementing the write operation once you've got those halves actually isn't that hard. However, a friendly word of advice. Every faculty member says, gosh, please don't be an idiot and wait until the last minute because this strategy won't work for you. And every student says, some of you were not immune to this misbehavior in the last assignment. One or two of you who were not immune to this behavior also did not seek help from the TAs in a timely fashion. I have zero sympathy for this behavior. I have less than zero sympathy for this behavior. This is a graduate level course. I expect you to organize your time and I expect you to behave like competent adults. So waiting until the last minute and not getting to the TA falls under the heading of potential earned F behavior. I expect you to look at the assignment. I expect you to do it. I expect not to prod you. And I apologize to all of you who did this the right way. The three of you who fall into the category I'm describing, I think all know who you are. And my advice to you is don't pull this shit again. Because I won't tolerate it. Anyways. Actually, I think the three of you, at least in abstract, I'm not going to call you out by name, but you actually owe an apology to the rest of the class for even making this conversation necessary. With apologies for that. Several of you have gone to God in one form or another and said, okay, there was all the stuff we talked about at the start of the semester, and we're kind of groping to see how the things we're doing now relate to that, because it's not obvious. And indeed, it isn't obvious. And I want to try to tackle a little bit of that question today. It's a little too early to be able to give a complete answer. I want to try to take a start at it. The first part of the answer is actually pretty simple. And it's the most mundane and least interesting and most boring part of the answer, right? Which is, look, obviously, if I can implement something like a zero stream or a pipe as a separate process, then if I assume, and it's a big assumption, but if I assume that the underlying kernel is operating correctly, and a zero stream fails to operate correctly, I have already narrowed the scope in which I need to search. Because there's nothing else in the address space that could be the culprit. So if something went wrong, it's either the implementation of the zero stream, which isn't that big. Not only is it not that big, but it's highly idiomatic. Right? There's a long list of obvious errors you could make writing any piece of code, right? But this is pretty much, once you get the hang of it, you can see that it's pretty much cookie cutter kind of code, most of it. Now, the pipe won't be altogether that way because it has some complex interactions. If you were to take all the code of the pipe, you could pretty well separate it between the stuff that you can implement with a cookie cutter and the stuff that's the heart of being a pipe object. Two pipes don't share any state, right? So it's not like crosstalk between one and the other could be your problem. So it's either the implementation of the object itself, which hopefully is small, or it's the implementation of the basic kernel abstractions. And that implementation, regrettably, is not small. And as we've seen, some of it is depressingly not straightforward. But it's at least very heavily exercised. So it's highly likely that in due course we'll catch a problem in it. And it's just occurred to me there's a major path in the kernel we haven't gone through that we need to. The most mundane part of the answer for reliability is, look, if we can break programs down into small bits that are isolated from each other, then we can actually talk about testing them in isolation. If they go wrong, we have a pretty good shot at figuring out who the culprit was. That's a qualitative statement, not a quantitative statement. Right? It's not something we can really straightforwardly measure, because if we were to compare this system to other systems, we'd be making an apples to oranges comparison. We could implement Linux on top of the Kyotis infrastructure. What we'd get would be a slow implementation of Linux that had all the flaws of Linux. Because the flaws of Linux are inherent in the API of Linux. You can't do a faithful implementation of Unix without incorporating some of those flaws. In fact, without incorporating most of those flaws. But that's sort of the simplest and most mundane answer, which is, and it boils down to, look, if you have a big complicated system, bringing it down into smaller, less complicated, more manageable systems has to significantly increase the robustness of the system, if only because it makes it easier to point the finger in the right place when something goes wrong. So when something goes wrong, you're more likely to catch it, right? If you throw a wild pointer error in a large GNOME application, right, what are you gonna hit? If you hit the code region, you're lucky, because that's read-only and you'll probably get an error pretty soon, assuming this was a write. If it's a read, I don't know. But if you hit some random data structure, whether you ever notice is a function of whether you later traverse that data structure. And there's an enormous amount of state in a GNOME application that never gets visited after it's initialized. And even if it were to get visited, you clobbered this state, you'd have to have clobbered it in some way that got caught by the processing that was done on this state. And there are two reasons why that might not happen. The first is you might get lucky. In a negative sense, right? That you might have clobbered it with a value that looks good enough not to catch you. Okay? This is not luck in the way that you want it. But the other possibility is that the overwhelming majority of software does not do validation on stored values, right? It assumes, and I think fairly reasonably, that at least if it had previously stored a known good value in a location, that the value there should be stable. course, it's the nature of wildpointer errors, this is not the case. I can still do bad values in languages that don't have wildpointer errors. I have to work a little harder at it. Not a lot harder, but some. So the less complexity you put in an address space, the happier you're going to be. Now, what you're going to pay for it is context switches and copies. And in our current examples, there are two sources of copies. One has to do with moving data across the address space boundary. So like in the zero stream sets up this huge buffer of zeros, and it has to get copied from one address space to the other. In the dev zero implementation in Linux, that doesn't happen because Linux is able to exploit the fact that it implicitly resides in your address space already. But when you do a read on dev zero in Linux, right, what it actually does is reach up into the buffer in your address space and write the zeros in place. When you do a read on the zero stream in Kyoto's, at best, it writes the buffers in place on the zero stream side and then copies the buffer. In fact, it doesn't do that either. Second copy, and the second copy is introduced by the IDL subsystem. IDL subsystem has to marshal the string into a place where it can be copied. But that's a reflection of a shortcoming in the current IPC mechanism that we intend to fix. Right now, there's no scatter-gather mechanism, and in the absence of that, the IDL subsystem has to do extra copies. It's a known flaw in the current design, it's a fixable flaw, and it's a compatibly fixable flaw, so we deferred solving it. It's there. But these copies basically are what you pay for address space boundaries. There are cases where with some fairly clever design, you can usually avoid them. So for example, the high-performance Ethernet subsystem that exists in the Arrows tree does not have any marginal copies having to do with address space boundaries. It has one marginal copy having to do with solving a protection problem. And it's a protection problem that Unix doesn't solve. So much for the mundane stuff. What we're getting here is a certain separation of function and therefore separation of failures. What about in the sort of larger scheme of things, what are capabilities buying us? I start in a Unix style system, right? One of the foundational assumptions in the Unix system is that there's a common file namespace that is accessible to everyone. We may have some kind of access control list mechanism that tries to narrow that. But both the baseline design of the system and the selection of defaults for protection tends to encourage the view that all files are at least visible to everyone. You actually have to go to extra effort in the way most systems are configured. If you set up an SSH key and you created a .ssh directory, on most Linux systems, the way they come out of the box, you actually have to take an extra step to remove world readability on that .ssh directory. Most Linux systems, the default umask is set up in such a way that when you create a file, it is world readable, group readable. Independent of that, there's just this tacit assumption that all file names have a common root in some kind of a hierarchical namespace. So your strategy for translating a file name and my strategy for translating a file name make reference to the same state. So in this sort of situation, it's very, very easy for things to become shared. Sometimes it's what you want, sometimes it's not. Unfortunately, if you're a virus writer, this is a nearly ideal thing. I mean, turn this on your head and stop asking for a second. I'm not saying this is unimportant, but stop asking for a second what's convenient to the end user who I'm trying to serve. And you ask yourself, what would be my top list of five features if my goal was to write viruses to infect a system? And number one would be I want the implementer to use C. Because long list of errors I can make running any piece of code and C won't help me find any of them. But C is your friend if you're a virus writer. Number two, I really want files to be readable to everyone. Because the more I can make files readable, the easier it is for me to propagate a virus from one place to another. I especially want template files to be both readable and writable, which unfortunately they tend to be. And it doesn't matter if they're global templates or just your templates, right? I mean, if I, the OpenOffice implementation, can rewrite the template files that are private to you, bingo, I've just propagated the virus to all of your documents forever. So template namespaces that are reused from one instantiation in the application to another, these are my friend if I'm a virus writer. I really like access to the network by default. Because viruses are no fun if I can't download more viruses. I'd have to think about what number 5 would be. Now, let's look at how these correlate with the features that are available to your typical program in Windows or Linux. You notice that all of these things are present. Missing. I mean, I'm sure we could come up with a few more. I once actually generated a list of sort of top 10 operating system features from the perspective of the virus writer. You know, and not surprisingly, they were highly correlated with what we see in kind of operating systems. Now, of course, the problem is that as a legitimate user, you want these things too. You want to be able to write files from your word processor. You want to be able to send things over a network. I'm not so clear that it's that simple. And let me suggest a different model. Suppose it were the case, and let me just focus for a minute on the interactive problem, because the batch problem is a different problem and it needs somewhat different solutions. Right now, if I'm a document processing system and I want to write a file, right? I may do it through the standard I/O library, but basically I call this thing open and I pass it a file name and I say I want to do this open for read-write and I want to create the file if it doesn't exist. Dennis was once heard to observe that leaving off the E in the create was the only substantial error in the Unix design. And if it already exists, I don't really care what's in it, so I want to truncate it. And assuming that I have done this open in a path where I have write permission, right, that's it. I get to open this file. It doesn't matter if this file is the one that I was supposed to open. And you actually have no idea if this file is the one that I was supposed to open. You have no visibility to the fact, as a user, have no visibility to the fact that open call happened at all. What's going on here, mentally, is that inside of the application, there actually is a descriptor, which is a capability of sorts, to the file system object. And the file system object has an open call, which at least implicitly takes some credentials that are my UID and my GID and something like that. And it takes a file name and some other arguments. But there's a bunch of assumptions in this design that are problematic. The first is credentials. So somehow I'm going to pass a piece of information that says something about who I am that the file system is going to use to make a permissions decision. And in Unix, the reason this is okay is these credentials are gathered by the operating system. They're extracted from the process structure. They're a form of protected payload. The second assumption is that whatever implements this file system behavior is trusted, that it can't forward my credentials to somebody else. There's a very bimodal line here between stuff that's fully trusted and stuff that's fully not. The whole world isn't that black and white. You may have noticed this. So I would argue that, in fact, the right model here was that the file system capability ought to have already embedded all of the permissions I need. Or not. But that my credentials have nothing to do with it. That's not the right model. And the reason that's not the right model is that my credentials is everything that I, the user, or the session, have the authority to do, which has only a tangential relationship to what I want the application to be able to do. I generally don't want my applications to run with all of my authority. Maybe my shell, maybe not even my shell, but certainly not Microsoft Word. Word is not my friend. Even if I trust all of the 250,000 programmers involved at Microsoft, right? There's another 500,000 who do plugins for this thing, and I don't know who they are. Some of them are probably good-spirited folks. Most of them are probably good-spirited folks. I can promise you they're not all perfect software developers. I can pretty well promise you they are all programming in C. But a few of them actually are hostile. And that's a huge body of code. It's more than can be reviewed by human beings. The model that every application should run with all of my authority is just fundamentally crazed. It's nuts. So, here's a proposition. If we're talking about an interactive system, it really ought to be the case that any file, perhaps barring a temporary file, my word processor writes, I ought to have said okay about that. Perhaps the right model here, it's not to go to the file system and say open and get back a descriptor. perhaps the right model is to go to something that looks like a file system. It obeys the file system interface. But perhaps it's not really the file system. So the proposition is that maybe what we ought to do, and I'm not proposing this as a serious design. I'm trying to put forward the idea of interposition. So this is not actually how I would propose to design a file system. Let's start with one issue at a time. So here's the real file system. Real file system in the sense that open calls on it are going to be honored in the classical way, although I hope not with the credentials component. And what we're going to do is we're going to front end this file system. Okay, so what's on this capability? It's the FS interface. We're going to front end this file system with something that we might call the open save as dialog. This is a curious beast because it implements an interface as well. This interface implements the file system protocol. The proposition is that what ought to happen is I ought never give the application access to the file system proper. What I ought to give it is access to the open save as dialog box. It's going to go ahead and do what it thinks is an open call. And the open save as dialog box is going to have a separate interface to the user interface such that it can pop up a dialog box to me that the application cannot suppress. There are some tricky trusted path issues in here that need to get resolved. But the proposition is that if we're a little bit careful about the design, there should be no way that the application can write a file, can even obtain write permission on a file without I, the user, having okayed it. And even my father, who is afraid of the off switch, this is good because I therefore know that he'll never listen to the recordings of this class. He's literally afraid of the off switch. I mean, his answer to turning off the computer is to call for my mother and ask her if it's okay. Even my father will become suspicious if the word processor starts spontaneously asking to write to files. He will sooner or later figure out that he didn't ask it to do that. And he'll wonder what's going on. Of course, on the right side of the discussion, this case is a little easier to make because writing tends to be the rare case. By the way, for temporary files, this obviously is not desirable. We sort of like applications to be able to build temporary files internally, do whatever they want with them, and I shouldn't have to get in the way of that. So why is it the case, what's the problem when I do open in slash temp? Is that a problem? That's certainly one problem, and also there's a race with various kinds of permissions on reopen. There's a long laundry list of security errors that are time of check to time of use errors related to temporary files, to the degree that there are now three equally broken interfaces in the shared scene library for making temporary files, none of which are right. Now, so what's the inherent error? First, what's the idiom? If I want to make a secure temporary file, what are the steps? It has to be perfect, which is, I hope not, because you missed an important step. Like the file. The observation is that create, or open, right? Open with o create is really the create system call. That will create a file, and you can then delete that file from the file system. As long as you still hold an open descriptor to it, the file won't go away. The reference count on the file and open descriptors are counted. So if you want to create a temporary file, and you want to make sure that nobody else can get it, you have to create it, but the next thing you should do is delete it while holding the open descriptor. Because once it's deleted, it doesn't matter what the permissions are on it. It's not there anymore. Of course, the problem is there's an intrinsic race between the time you create the file and the time you delete it. What's really going on here is there are two distinct operations that are getting convolved in the open operation. One has to do with creating an object. The other has to do with binding that object into a namespace. These two steps are separable, but they are not separated in the Unix interface. All of the time of check to time of use errors in Unix devolve from the fact that these operations are not separable. One proposition would be to add a flag, anon, which says, notwithstanding the fact that I had to pass a string to the interface for legacy reasons, don't actually bind this in the namespace at all. Why do I need, because the interface won't let me, and B, because the string that I hand in is actually, I was about to say, is actually serving a dual purpose. One is it's telling me the name of the file I want to create, but the other is somewhere along that path, it implicitly tells me the file system in which I want to create the object. And so that tells me something about where the resources are coming from. So I probably still need a path, even if at the end I don't want a file created, at least in the Unix model. There's a proposition hiding in here that namespaces are potentially dangerous things. And that binding is the act that tends to make things public. And it's not something that you want to be forced to do. But perhaps what we should do, ignoring the Unix interface, is say, look, if the application wants to create a temporary file, let it go ahead and create a temporary file. As long as that temporary file is private to the application, we don't have a problem. The problem comes when that application gets bound into a public namespace. So in the Eros file system design, the file system doesn't have any notion of name binding at all. It implements file objects. That's all it does. You can create a file object, you get back a capability, it knows how to do read and write, close. Capability. If you want to bind that capability into a directory, that's up to you. That's not up to the file system. The name binding mechanism is a human convenience. Separation between binding and object creation. Secondary consequence of this, which is that you can bind things in the namespace that aren't files. You can create an entry capability to a process and stick that in a namespace. A two-edged sword, and it's very nice to be able to do that. The downside to it is, in contrast to Unix, it is not the case that every descriptor is a string. And that's almost but not quite true in Unix. So you get a commonality of protocol in Unix that you don't get in an object-based system that's occasionally tricky. One of the propositions of the Plan 9 system is that you could get most of the advantage of an object system while still preserving the everything is a string discipline. And I think they make a credible case for it, although I think that there are places where they bite off more complexity for that than they needed to. There are some reductio problems at the bottom of Plan 9. Okay. You might implement this mediator, this open save as mediator, in a way that was slightly less naive. You may say, if what I want to implement is something that simulates the Unix behavior, I might recognize that slash temp is a place about which we have some strong conventions. And if the application says, I want to open a file in temp, I might go ahead and say, OK. And I might record here a binding between that file and that name without recording it in the real file system. I might thereby enforce the idea, A, that this temp file is actually only accessible within the namespace of the application, Ultron. B, that binding does not survive the exit of the application. There's no reason, by and large, for you and I to have access to the same slash temp. So the idea here is that by putting all of the onus on descriptors, you start to be able to do interposition and various kinds of guardian applications. For example, you take the same idea and apply it to the network subsystem. Just because the socket interface allows you to say you want to open a connection to any machine in the world, doesn't mean you should get it. Because it's possible to put a filter there and say, fine, you want to open a connection, you know, to mumble.ru. So why exactly are you connecting to a machine in Romania while I'm editing my, you know, my financials for my company? This doesn't seem intuitive. Maybe cases where even we do it dynamically and say, hey, we have some content on this machine that we know is sensitive. And we can keep track of where this application is connected to. If it is connected to Romania, perhaps we should no longer allow it to read the company financials. Conversely, if it has read the company financials, perhaps it's no longer appropriate to speak to Romania. Nothing against Romania, for the record. It just seems to be a site, you know, it just seems to be a place where a lot of these sites pop up, unfortunately. Kind of part and parcel with this idea of front-ending is the idea that there should not be ambient authority. So what's ambient authority? Ambient authority is authority that I have, that I do not have to designate at the point of use, and that I get usually implicitly, simplifying a bit. So for example, when I fork off a Unix process, there's a bunch of things that it gets by magic. It gets all of my credential information. It gets access to the file system. It gets access to the network subsystem. It gets access to the process list, at least within some constraints. Certainly gets as much access as I have. A lot of authority. The argument is, every last one of those is something that the application should not have just gotten by magic. Each of those is something that we might reasonably want to constrain. And some of those, if actually used, are things where we might want to reject the use. There is no reason for most applications to have access to the process list, the system. You might say, well, why do we care? The answer most of the time will be we don't. Because most of the uses of this information are completely innocuous. The problem is, it only takes one or two exceptions to that statement to be really hurt. So the design model needs to be, in the end, I mean, I'm not talking about it for legacy applications, but the design model for forward-looking applications needs to be, we need to be building applications that can operate successfully on the least authority they can get away with, not on the most authority we can give them. Unix, at least, when I start a word processor, doesn't usually give it more authority than I have, although the operative word is usually. But the password program is an exception to this statement. For legacy applications, we need to be able to build cocoons that give these applications the appearance of the interface that they're accustomed to, with sharply reduced actual authority and with much greater auditing of what's going on. That's possible. Since I put the password program in the loop, let me propose a different design for the password program. Unix password program is a great example of how not to build a secure program. In fact, that's pretty much true for anything in the Unix tree that's marked setuid or setgid. Why do we use the setuid or the setgid mechanism? Generally because some file or files, or some access right, but usually it turns out to be a file, we don't want you to have access to unless you're running some program that we have reason by prior design to trust. So we take something like password and we make it set UID so that it has the authority to read the password file when you execute it, even though you do not. Why is this bad? Well, the problem was that we had this file as in password, it was readable to root. We have this program password, or SBIN password, I guess it is nowadays, moving it around on me. This thing is running under two sets of credentials. Yours, which is the wrong set, because it doesn't have access to password. And root's, which is the wrong set, because it has access to a hell of a lot more than the password file. And the only reason this is even remotely okay is that the Etsy password program is so obsessively simple. Would that that were true. A little bit of analysis will convince you that the SBIN password program only runs a couple of 100,000 lines of code. At last check, there were at least 5 different password hashing mechanisms being implemented. There's the MD5 shadow mechanism. There's the SHA-1 mechanism, right? There's the legacy SALT mechanism. Now there's going to be the SHA-256 mechanism. Each one of these has a boatload of library support. Where does that library support live? Anybody going to guess? Let's see. What does it depend on? Hell if I know. Hell if you know. Probably the dynamic loader is certainly in the list. But the point is, the list is pretty big. And there's some of it we can enumerate off the top of our heads. And we were done. When we were done with that enumeration, we would surely have missed a bunch of stuff. Okay. So I don't know what that program that runs as root uses, neither do you and neither do the people who wrote it. That's actually an example of a program that's fairly well audited in the Unix world. Here's a proposition. What was the root cause, you'll pardon the pun, of this program needing to run as root? Root cause was our friend Open. Had it not been for Open, this program would not have needed to run as root. What we wanted, because what's going to happen is, Etsy password is going to invoke the Open call, and that's going to get a file descriptor that's going to point to some file that you and I know happens to be follow the convention of the password file. Oh, by the way, among the sources of complexity, right, I left out all of the ways in which password can go wrong because it doesn't have a transactional system under it and it's updating several files at once. Suppose instead it was possible for the password program to just hold the descriptor in the first place. Here's the test question. there any reason for the password file? Why is it necessary that this text blob that is the content of the password file, why is it necessary that this have any binding in the file system namespace at all? Why is that required? No, you know that. Or at least I suspect you know. Can you repeat that loud enough for me to hear it?
No, basically you need to store it somewhere.
I certainly need to store it somewhere, yes.
Right, and...
Okay, so I agree that the blocks that embody the content, the blocks that are used to store this file have to come out of a file system in the Unix model of the world. Fine. Why does it need a name? Well, no, I mean, we've already falsified that because we established earlier that I could create a file in temp and immediately unlink it. And that file remains in /temp as long as there's a process accessing it. Why do we need a name? Open an existing file without a name. You're exactly right. Wait a minute. You're exactly right. Why is that a problem? I'm sorry?
We restart
and we lose everything. So the heart of the problem here is that part of the system is persistent and part of the system is not. That's true of every system I know about, including Coyotes. In this case, unfortunately, the dividing line was put in a very inconvenient place because we can't hold an open descriptor across system failures. Now, I don't think I'm going to go so far as to argue that etcpassword should not be in the namespace. There's a future-proofing problem if we don't put it there. We may come up with a future application that has good reason to want access to etcpassword. But if password, the program, could intrinsically retain a descriptor to the file across restarts, it wouldn't need root access. And that story, by the way, would do away with almost every use of setuid and setgid in the Unix system. And there's a piece of work by Mark Seaborn, something called Plash, which is trying to do this kind of authority reduction for conventional applications. So what Plash does is builds essentially a false file system that it cheroots in by linking things. And then it cheroots into it, it runs your application in this false file system where there simply isn't any stuff the application shouldn't have, runs the application there, and then copies the output back out, which is trying to retrofit this kind of name control onto current applications. Let's go back to another aspect of the password program. Why does the password program need to exist? Aside from the issue of root access, there are two kinds of mistakes I could make with the content of the password file. And one is I could engage in hostility. Right? I could clear it, I could delete it, I could do all kinds of rude stuff like that. The other purpose of the password program. A hint? Never attribute to malice what can be accounted for by stupidity. Is the password file just an arbitrary sequence of bytes? Any set of bytes do? No. I'm going to take a chance here.
It has a specific format.
It has a what?
Specific format.
It has a specific format. Right? It's a record structured file that's been overlaid onto a character model. This is one of the weaknesses of the Unix system and one of the strengths. Everything is a file of characters, which means if what you wanted was a file of records, that's actually hard to get. It's got to be retrofit on top of the character model. And the argument was, that stuff's pretty simple to do. You should do it in a library. And that argument was credible, except that it ignored the problem of validation. The password file has a format. Each line has to have a particular number of fields. Certain fields have to have particular properties in order to be well-formed. Login name cannot contain certain characters. But the UID has to fall within the range of representable UIDs. The encrypted password at least has to be a syntactically well-formed serialization of an encrypted password. There are constraints on what can be in what's called the GCOS field. If you know what the hell GCOS was. That's pretty funny. 30 years since the last GCOS system ran, and people still know what the hell it was. The home directory name ought to be a directory name, or at least it ought to be something like a directory name. So actually, a lot of the job of the password program is what we might call integrity guarantees. Its job is to make sure that the data in the password file is well-formed. And we don't tend to think of that because we tend to think about the security issues in the password program. If the data in the password file is malformed, it ceases to matter whether it's secure. Because it ceases to have any meaning. One of the reasons that there is now a file called password minus, so that you have some place to go if a bad block comes up in your primary password file. Because if that bad lock hits you in the wrong place, man, you're toast. So how does all this relate to capabilities? I want to kind of draw out a couple of patterns here. The first is that a lot of things that are going on in namespaces are a consequence of a certain kind of failure of persistence. There are many cases where if you'd had process persistence, you wouldn't have required namespaces in certain places, and you certainly wouldn't have required things like root access or set UID. Second is, if everything is by a descriptor, and if descriptors are always passed explicitly, not implicitly, then you stand in a position to interpose on them. That gives you a certain intrinsic control over authority, even dynamic authority. It also makes it much easier to build what we might call encapsulated environments. If I start up a universe in some newly fabricated file system, the file system exhibits the name structure that your programs expect, your program has no way to tell that it's not running on the real one. Maybe I give it a network subsystem that simply says no to all attempts to connect. I can't tell the difference between that and my network is turned off. Maybe I interpose with the open save as dialog box so the user gets a chance to approve. I'm a little clever about it so that this isn't unreasonably invasive. Files, I expect Word to open, right? It certainly has to be able to bind its own dynamic libraries. There's certain content on the system that I might as well label public because, frankly, you could install the same system. It's not like hiding these bits from you does any good. But if I can see the dynamic library bits for a given version of Linux, so can you, right? Trying to make them secret is just stupid. But the proposition here is we want to be able to do this sort of interposition as a means of imposing security, and we also want to be able to limit authority. And we want to be able to limit how authority propagates. So the fact that every program I run runs with my credentials is a problem. In a capability system, if I run a program, it gets that authority that I give it, and no more. Constructor mechanism, right? Remember the constructor mechanism has this guarantee that, or can enforce this guarantee that the program that it starts has no writable access to anything? Read-only state is not authority. Read-only state does not give you any ability to modify the state of the machine. If you don't have the ability to modify the state of the machine, you don't have the ability to do anything horrifying. The reason that test is important is it tells you that the only ways in which that program can successfully misbehave are based on authority that you gave it. Because that was the only authority that potentially allowed it to alter the state of the system. Furthermore, if you interpose that authority carefully, it may be able to recover even if it does mess with the state of the system in the wrong, in an undesired way. And wrong here is a value judgment. In the limit, we're going to carry this out even to the creation of user accounts. When your account gets created on a system, there is no intrinsic reason why you should share any namespace with me. We'll soon start inventing some, right? We're going to want a namespace of people we can send emails to. We're going to need to be able to bootstrap connectivity between users. But the one thing I can tell you is that those mechanisms of connectivity should not be widely available. There's no reason that my word processor needs to be able to send email. Certainly no reason that it should be able to send email without going through the email agent that talks to me. This idea that all applications should be able to do anything they want is nuts. It's exactly opposite from the direction we want to go. And then the last bit, and this is a little bit subtle, and I'll stop with the first half, and I'll switch gears. How do you think first about security problems? But robustness issues have some of the same flavor. And let me try to explain that as best I can. Suppose I have a subsystem that fails. Something goes wrong, maybe it runs out of space, maybe there's an error in the code. In some way it fails. Hopefully I'll get some kind of an exception message, and the thing will cease operating. The really bad case is it fails and continues to operate. That's the really nasty case. Assume it fails, what might it affect? Can I point to the things that could be caused to misbehave as a consequence of this failure? What are the consequential damages? Can I draw some line and say, beyond this scope, that thing can't have any real result? Do you have a thought there?
The capability system to you.
Correctly or transmittably? Constantly, that's right. Basically, look, you can only affect the things you can communicate with. That might be quite a large set. The problem is, in Unix, that's the entire system. In Kyotos, if you structure things a little carefully, it might be less than the entire system. And if you actually check messages as they go by, it rapidly becomes much less than the entire system. Look, if things are going wrong, the likelihood that everything will continue to generate well-formed messages is approximately zero. Well, the likelihood that things will continue to generate messages is approximately zero. But certainly, if you're checking results, somebody's going to trip somewhere. And you can ask, how far did the error propagate? And you can also say, okay, here I'm going to draw a line, and at this line, I'm going to explicitly implement cross-checks on my results. I've done a set of operations, and I sort of expect that when those operations are done, the data structure ought to look like something. And if the data structure looks like what I expect, there ought to be a set of queries I could give that will give me answers that will at least qualitatively confirm that the data is in a plausible state. For some data, the answer is, if the data is not in a plausible state, who the hell cares? And for some data, the answer is no, it bloody matters. The proposition is not that you should be forced to exercise this care on everything. The proposition is that you should have the opportunity to exercise this care where it is warranted and appropriate. And the system infrastructure should admit the possibility of design in which this care can be exercised, which Unix does not. The reason Unix does not is because in two steps, any two processes can communicate. The first step is create a temp file, and the second step is open the temp file. Bingo, you and I can communicate. There's no possibility in the standard Unix system of putting any kind of a scoping boundary on information flow. You see things like AppArmor and SE Linux and systems like this trying to retrofit such a model on Unix, and you may have noticed it doesn't work so well. Right. The single most common response to active experience running SE Linux is to turn it off. Unfortunately, there are good reasons for that. And some of it is that SE Linux is just too damn complicated, and some of it is that SE Linux is always trailing in a battle to keep up with how the applications have changed. What happens is the applications change, and then somebody has to update the policy, and there's always a delay. The policy is always wrong and too complicated.
Isn't that sort of inherent into really complicated
policies? Which suggests something about really complicated security policies.
Yes and no.
I would argue it doesn't make things harder, unless expressing policies is unnatural in the framework of the system that you're working in. So the question to ask yourself is, look at the things that SE Linux prohibits. Ask yourself, if you had been able to simply structure the system with the right descriptors held by the right parties and preserve that relationship across system shutdown, is there anything you couldn't do by prior construction that SE Linux is trying to retrofit at runtime? I suggest to you the answer is no. The reason I think the answer is no is I've had this conversation with Steve Small. Steve's very straightforward that SE Linux is attempting to do static policy enforcement. It's not trying to look at dynamic policy. Static policy enforcement is actually very easy to do in capability systems. The difference is, capability systems can do dynamic policy enforcement as well. SE Linux could, and it can be extended for that, but that's not currently within the scope of its design. And there is sort of the problem that the policy is separated from the applications. And that can be good if you take the view, well, I want a second opinion about whether the policy makes sense. If that's your view, you want the policy implementer to be separate from the application implementer. But if your belief is the application implementers are basically decent folks and you're trying to help them constrain the behavior of their application, then what you want is for the application implementers to take responsibility for the policy. And the fact is, empirically, they don't. There are some who do. Those SE Linux policies work. And the rest are the ones that cause you to turn off SE Linux. Or even worse, learn how SE Linux works so you can patch the policy. The problem with patching the policy is then the next update, your patch ceases to work, right? I've been on both sides of that. And then the AppArmor solution says, well, there's a social binding between names in the namespace and things I want to protect. And so I can treat the names as equivalent to the objects, and I can implement a name-based protection scheme, which is much simpler to specify, covers 80% of the cases that are observed in the wild, and is actually administrable by real human beings, even when the application authors have not cooperated. That's a pretty strong argument, and Crispin's team did some very good work on that problem. It's not as strong as SE Linux, but the argument is it doesn't have to be. right? That a stronger system that's not usable may be weaker than a weaker system that's actually usable. Today, if the system's only good as its utilization. Probably a longer answer than you wanted on that topic. I don't have enough experience with AppArmor to talk about its strengths and weaknesses, but
I need to get you the ability to speak up. Per user namespaces, something that are parameters.
Application namespaces. Okay, if you start from the assumption that everything proceeds from namespace, a way to retroactively achieve some of this kind of protection is to say, well, every time I start a new application, I will custom build it in a new namespace. And typically, I won't do that stupidly, right? So I will have some baseline namespace, which is purely read-only. This is the system namespace. Everything in it is read-only and public. Think of it as the basic install, right? So there's no point worrying about secrets in that. And then I will overlay onto that something like a home directory, which might be empty, right? And an application namespace. And what you get if you push down that direction approximately is plan 9. What's missing in that story is this kind of interposition. So that's good at separating one user from the next. It's tougher to separate one application from the next because you want, I think they actually could have done a lot of that kind of interposition in Plan 9, but as far as I know, they did not. I think it's an interesting experiment to ask, how far could that be pushed? Of all the systems that I've looked at that were sort of namespace oriented, Plan 9 comes closest to having an interface where you could retrofit a capability style of design onto it. Also, and maybe more important, the Plan 9 file system model gets authentication all the way out to the user, not just to the client system. The Unix distributed namespace authentication model is, well, the client says you're you and I trust the client. The problem is I never know what's on the client. And I've actually had this discussion with the Plan 9 guys, and it's just the project was ending before they got a chance to explore it. But I think it's worth exploring, actually. One system call is different. What you need to make this work is you need a notion of, first, you need a notion of a per-process namespace, which Unix has always been schizophrenic about. You need a union mount mechanism that works robustly. That doesn't exist in Linux yet. There's been some good work. I want to say Syracuse, but don't hold me to that. There is this UnionFS thing, but it's got deadlocks left and right. And not because the people doing it are stupid, but because it's intrinsic in the POSIX interface that should be the case. And also because not all the file system implementations are well-behaved. But mostly you need private namespaces. I want to say Ron Minnick did some work on that he was never, as far as I know, able to negotiate into the core Linux implementation. And this is one of these things that if I have to patch the system to do it, it's not going to get exercised. So it's hard to know what to do about that. Some of the work did go in. There's a clone mount mechanism that went in. There's cross directory mounting that went in. So some of it's, it's been going in one bit at a time, and I haven't kept track of it. I remember thinking it was very frustrating that model couldn't be done on Linux because it was sort of one of the big holes. And it was one of those sort of beautiful ideas that had obvious application and could be done backward compatibly. I mean, the Plan 9 guys have basically demonstrated that. And I don't quite understand what the resistance to it was. The Linux core community has a level of not invented here and everybody else is a shithead that has to be seen in action to be believed. I don't think that was all of the case here. There have been other cases I can point to where that was really all of the case. They really don't accept that people who've been in the OS business 30 years longer than they have might know anything. Sometimes that turns out to be justified, but not as often as they think. Okay. So, is this starting to give a little bit of a hint of why this capability idea is potentially powerful? I'm not arguing this is the only way to go. In fact, we've just kind of, at a very high level, glossed a design in which you might go at this a different way, and you might go at this in a way that had a higher degree of backward compatibility. You might go down the Plan 9 namespace route. The problem I anticipate in Plan 9 being the cost of creating these private namespaces is potentially quite large. And this has some back pressure. Right? It creates a disincentive to fire up a new application, and it creates a strong incentive to put more function in every application. The more function you put in the application, the bigger it gets, right? And the single best thing you can do to reduce the number of flaws in the application is to cut the number of lines of code in the application. So things that penalize starting applications are not your friend. Then another interesting question from that is, could you do descriptor durability? You could shut down a Plan 9 system with its processes intact and resume it. And given the way the Plan 9 mount logic bootstraps, I don't know if that's feasible. And that's something that I never had occasion to talk to them about. I think it's an interesting question. There is a reductio at the bottom of their mount system that's clearly busted, and they agree that it's busted. And I think if you were to close out that reductio, you could... No, you couldn't. Let me explain why I think it'd be very hard to make Plan 9 persistent. I mean, in abstract, I think you could take a system that had basically the same API and you could make it persistent. Plan 9 wasn't designed with that in mind. So why is that hard? In order to make a system persistent, you basically have to be able to take all of the definitive kernel data structures, the ones that hold state that you have to preserve, you have to be able to quiesce them, and you have to be able to serialize them in some canonical way. The mechanism to do this isn't actually that complicated. But the last thing you want to do is save bad state. So there are many cases in a Unix system where you have data structures that have circular pointer relationships. Circular pointer relationships are not your friend in a persistent system. You may use them for performance, but not to describe anything definitive. And of course, when you serialize things, you can't rely on the addresses, because those addresses will change when you reload. So you need to have every object in the system have a unique ID. And there are elements of the Unix system that are not friendly to that. For example, when I hold a file descriptor, it points to a struct file. The struct file points to typically a vnode entry. Okay. The struct file is only a couple of words. If I add a unique ID to every struct file, that almost doubles its size. It would be an interesting experiment to say, what would it take to persist a Unix system given the data structures that exist? But the data structure complexity of the system is actually quite high. And there are a comparable number of data structures at the end of the day. Well, ignoring the fact that drivers are out of the picture and networks are out of the picture, right? So that takes a lot off the table. But if I take those out of the Linux picture, the complexity of the data structures in Kyotos are probably just as high as the complexity in the Unix system. The difference is, the overwhelming majority of those data structures hold no definitive state. They don't have to be saved. And we're pretty careful about that. And the other thing that helps is the atomic system call mechanism. So we can stop the system, look at each system and call and say either, okay, that one's done or that one hasn't started. If you've got to save things in the middle, now there's more kernel state you have to save so that you can restart them. And that looks very complicated to me. Finally, I would say that Plan 9 has some denial of resource attacks inherent in its API that appear to me to be quite bad. And the initial reaction from the Plan 9 team was that they'd given no thought to that and then scratched their head and said, oh yeah, if I wanted to make one of these things crash, it would take no effort at all. One of the differences between research systems and production systems is research systems don't have to work all the time. I will leave it to you to determine whether or not that should be considered an indictment of systems research. I believe it should. If you take out half the requirements, it's very easy to make systems arbitrarily fast. It doesn't mean they're good summons. Let's break. By the way, I'm gonna try to end a little early today. Thanksgiving is coming up, and I think this may be the only class you guys have that did not luck into a vacation day somewhere. So I want to end a little early today. I do have another topic I want to hit, but let's take a break and come back in about 5 minutes.